all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
Hey, and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, Chief Warrant Officer, United States Army Aviator, 1968-69. I want to welcome you to our program today. We've got a couple of rotor heads on today, so we're really excited to talk about helicopters and history and some of the other things that went on in our lives when we were in Vietnam and when we were stateside. So our guests are going to include Ed Ludenberger, who is a communications director for the National Vietnam War Museum out in Weatherford, Texas. For those of you that went to flight school out in Fort Walters, it's only a mile away. So Ed's going to be on in just a minute to talk about that. And then a little bit later on in the program, we've got another helicopter pilot. That's Captain Tom Stempke, and he was a Charlie Model gunship pilot. And I think he probably ended up, I'll find out later on. And he was with the 186th Assault Helicopter Company. And we're going to be talking, as I said, helicopters, some of our experiences there. And I think it's going to be kind of fun today. This is going to be a treatment for all of us. Sometimes when we tell these stories, you know, here on Veterans Radio, we are big proponents of talking our stories out. And that usually helps us in the long run. Because we realized that some of the things that we did were really amazing, and that, you know, we have every right to be proud of what we were able to accomplish. And so I'm excited to do that. I want to make sure that I'll let you know that we thank our sponsors today. That would include Legal Help for Veterans. And Legal Help for Veterans, of course, is a disability specialist law firm that specializes in helping veterans with their disability claims. For more information, you can go to their website. That's legalhelpforveterans.com. And the other one is the Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And for more information about them, you can go to va.gov/Ann Arbor. We really do appreciate all of the sponsors that are helping Veterans Radio stay on the air. And I'm going to be talking about a couple of other ones later on in the program. But if you'd like to sponsor Veterans Radio, all you got to do is go to our website. That's veteransradio.net and click on the little button that says sponsors. And since we've changed ourselves, I guess you could say, from a a nonprofit for-profit corporation, we have now turned ourselves into an official nonprofit 501c3, and your donations would normally be tax deductible. You have to check with your financial advisor on that for sure. But you could also do that by just going again to our website, and you can click on the donate button. And I also want to remind people that are listening to Veterans Radio for the first time that we have been on the air for 19 years now. I know, hard to believe, right? And it's been quite the adventure. And we have had the privilege of talking to veterans from World War II, actually World War I. We had to talk to a World War I veteran a long time ago, all the way up through the current conflicts that America's military are involved in around the world. And it has been an honor to be able to tell those stories. So we're going to go right into our first guest. And I just remembered. If you have a question for today's program, you can give us a call at 734-822-1600. 734-822-1600. All right. So when I went to flight school back in 1968, it was out in Fort Walters, Texas. And Fort Walters, Texas, I'm guessing is probably somewhere around 50 miles west of Fort Walter or from Fort Worth and Dallas. And there was a little town called Weatherford in between on the way. And so when we would go into the big city on weekends, when they would let us, we would come back through Weatherford, and my friend Ray and I would go to the movies. Every Sunday afternoon that we got the weekend off, we would go to the movies at a little Weatherford theater, and it looked exactly like the theater in The Last Picture Show, for those of you that are into movies and so forth. And it was quite the adventure. But now there is a museum there, and it is the National Vietnam War Museum. And joining me on the line right now is Edward Ludenberger, And he is a communications director. He is was a captain in the United States Army, and he was a Chinook pilot. So I said, we've got rotor heads everywhere today. So Ed, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale. And just because it has happened for all my life, it's actually Lutenberger.
Lutenberger, okay. It looks like I need an umlaut.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So Ed Lutenberger, former captain, communications director, COO of the National Vietnam War Museum. Tell me how this whole thing got started, Ed.
Back in 1994, a group of former helicopter pilots formed the first local chapter of the Vietnam Helicopter Pilots Association in Mineral Wells, Texas. And at that meeting, we decided that we wanted to do something to create a legacy. And out of that came the idea for the National Vietnam War Museum. Originally, we had planned on just building a small helicopter museum there in Mineral Wells. And we sat down with some consultants, and they told us we were thinking too small. They said, what you really need to do is think on a larger scale. And we came up with the idea for the National Vietnam War Museum to cover not only the Vietnam War, but the Vietnam era, because there was so much going on, not only in Vietnam, but here in the home front and worldwide. And we worked on this concept for a number of years. In 1999, we were able to purchase a 12-acre piece of property just east of Fort Walters. And through private donations and everything that the museum has done has been through private donations. We were able to pay off that piece of property. And it kind of sat idle because we didn't have a lot of cash. And in 2007, our landlord had told us that we really needed to do something to develop the property, or he wanted it back. So we designed and opened our first garden called a meditation garden. And the meditation garden is filled with native plants. It's got a labyrinth walk through there. One of the first things we did was start selling bricks, memorial bricks, which line the walk in that garden. The following year, we acquired a Huey that had a Vietnam pedigree, and we mounted it on a 20-foot pole. And we opened our second garden. And in that garden, in addition to the Huey, we have a replica of the Camp Holloway Wall that was built by members of the, I believe it was the 52nd Aviation Battalion, to replace the one that they could not bring back with them from Vietnam. And there's a set of rotor blades in there that those of you who went through Fort Walters will also remember. That were at the Holiday Inn in downtown Mineral Wells. They were donated to us by the people that own the current hotel, and they are in that garden. The following year, and we were doing something every year at this point. The following year, we opened our replica of the wall in Washington, D.C. It's a half-scale replica, and to the best of our knowledge, it's the only one that is up to date with the one in D.C. because for 15 years, we kept adding names when they added. The year after that, we opened our visitor's center. And our visitor's center is also an artifact. It's a double-wide trailer that served as the headquarters for the staff at the Crawford Ranch when President Bush was in residence. Following that, we decided that it was time to build a permanent building. And we started, we broke ground on that in 2017. We completed it during the pandemic. It's a 20,000 square foot, two-story building. And we had our grand opening building in June of this year. And the grand opening was attended by about 700 people, including a large contingent of former Vietnamese military, South Vietnamese military. And the gentlemen were all in uniform. The ladies were in native Bao Dai costumes. And in addition to them, we had a large contingent of former Vietnam veterans who all attended. Since that opening, we've been averaging about 51 people a day coming through. I think the September count was 1,173 visitors. We've had groups as high as 100. We've had school groups come through. We just had a board meeting, a board of directors meeting yesterday. And one of the things that was reported was that we had a group that actually camped out there on the facility. So it's been 25 years of blood, sweat, tears, and something has finally come to fruition. And now we're planning to start on phase two, which will be another 20,000 square feet, a second building attached to the first. In the current building, we have what we call three galleries. We've got an introductory gallery, which takes you from the French occupation of Vietnam through parts of the war. We have a replica of the Oval Office set up right now in the LBJ era. And then we have the Fort Walters, Camp Walters Gallery, which includes an OH-23D painted up like a school bird. For those of you who are not familiar with Camp Walters, it was the largest infantry replacement training center during World War II. And one of the more famous trainees that passed through that was a young man from Texas by the name of Audie Murphy.
We talked about one of the books that was written about Audie Murphy, and they were talking about Camp Walters and his going through there. And my reason for contacting you, Ed, about the National Vietnam War Museum was that my son was recently out there, and he went through the museum, and he sent me a picture of the OH-23, which is what I went through. You know, my basic flight training was in that thing. And he said, "Did you really fly that?" And I said, "Yeah, I did." And he goes, "It doesn't look very safe." And I said, "It wasn't, you know." But I was just thinking, I know our audience, I want you to picture. I really do want you to go to their website. It's a great website. They've got some great photos there of not only their displays, but their, you know, what their plans are for the future and so forth. And you can really support this great organization. But when he was talking about the rotor blades that used to be in front of the hotel in downtown Miserable Wells, is that it was by the swimming pool. And when you, the day that you soloed, you would, the bus that would bring you back to Fort Walters would stop off at the pool, and all the pilots that soloed on that particular day got thrown in the pool. And it was a great day for so many people because we were so sure that we were never going to solo to begin with. And of course, the instructor pilots and attack officers did everything they could to convince us that we were idiots. Mostly successfully, it seemed like. But so I did want to just mention that because I have a picture just above me here of me standing between the rotor blades with the two other guys that soloed the day. And of course, we're soaked and, you know, we looked like drowned rats. But it was such a big deal. I mean, it really was a big deal. So you've got a Huey on a pedestal and you've got an OH-23. Have you got any plans for trying to grab onto other aircraft?
Well, actually, we have some other aircraft. You mentioned the OH-23. We have two of them. The second one is flyable, and we've actually given rides in that one.
Not me.
And for phase two, we have another Huey UH1H that will be in the museum on the floor so that people can get up close and personal with it. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the OH-23 again, that was also the aircraft that I flew. And the reason that I did, I think, was because I had a friend who had gone through the prior year and told me that when you get to Fort Walter, stretch up as tall as you can so that they'll put you in an OH-23 instead of killer TH-55.
Yeah, the Mattel Messerschmitt.
Yes.
Which was a really little helicopter that tall people can't really fit into. Sort of like the OH-6 Loaches that, you know, you had to be under a certain height to get in into the Loach, you know, and operate the controls. But so if I wanted more information about your museum, Edward, where would I go?
The best place to go is to our website, which is www.nationalvnwarmuseum.org.
Okay. So I encourage people to do that. And I encourage you when you're driving across the country, because everybody, it seems like, wants to is finally ready to get out and, you know, hit the road again. So, you know, head out there toward Dallas, Fort Worth, and just keep going west out to a beautiful place I remember they called Possum Kingdom Lake. Which I couldn't, being from New Jersey, when I told people that the recreational site nearby was called Possum Kingdom Lake, they were having a pretty good time with that one. But I'm assuming that it's a really nice state park. I don't think I ever got there, but anyway, go ahead.
If you did your pinnacle and slope training, you were on the banks of it.
Okay. All right. I was wondering how they got pinnacles out there in the middle of nowhere, Texas. And it was interesting. But it turned out to be a really great adventure. You know, the first part of the adventure of becoming a pilot, and wow, the instructors were just amazing. And, you know, anyway, it was fun. You know, I'm sitting here flashing back to all these things and imagining the TAC officers. You guys didn't have to worry about TAC officers at that point. You had already gone through that, but, you know, where you'd spend, you know, 8 hours polishing a cement floor, and the guy would come through with his cleats on his heels, and he would turn around and he'd go, "Look, there's a hole in their floor here. You got do that again." just the way that it was. And I want to thank you so very much. Let us know if there's anything we can do to help promote the museum. And, you know, when you have more displays or exhibits, let us know. I'd love to have you back on and, you know, to talk about the museum, but also talk about your experiences as a Chinook pilot, which is really just a scary thing to me.
Any time, Dale, any time. Mm-hmm. And you know, just for folks who don't know, the Chinook was probably the best money that the United States Army ever spent, because it's been in the inventory since 1962. And they don't have a replacement for it yet.
No, they keep going to those big, you know, airplanes with the wings that tilt and stuff, and that's no good. So anyway, thank you very much, Ed Lutenberger from the National Vietnam War Museum. Thanks very much, Ed.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to be taking a break here. And after we play our little Medal of Honor and thing, we're going to come back with our next guest, which is a gunship pilot from Vietnam. And his name is Tom Stempke. And we're going to be talking with Tom about his experiences and probably telling a few war stories here and there as we go along. So stick around. You're listening to Veterans Radio, and we will be back after this short message.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Army Captain Ed Freeman flew 14 rescue missions under intense enemy fire, saving 30 seriously wounded soldiers. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. 4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
As a flight leader, Freeman supported a heavily engaged American infantry battalion in the I Trang Valley in the Republic of Vietnam. The unit was almost out of ammunition after taking some of the heaviest casualties of the war, fighting off a relentless attack from a highly motivated, heavily armed enemy force. When the infantry commander closed the helicopter landing zone due to intense direct enemy fire, Freeman risked his own life by flying his unarmed helicopter through a gauntlet of enemy fire time after time, delivering critically needed ammunition, water, and medical supplies to the besieged battalion. His flights had a direct impact on the battle's outcome by providing the engaged units with timely supplies of ammunition critical to their survival. After medical evacuation helicopters refused to fly into the area due to intense enemy fire, Captain Freeman flew 14 separate rescue missions, providing life-saving evacuation of an estimated 30 seriously wounded soldiers, some of whom would not have survived had he not acted. All flights were made into a small emergency landing zone within 100 to 200 yards of the defensive perimeter, where heavily committed units were perilously holding off the attacking elements.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit veteranscrisisline.net. Veteranscrisisline.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
Hey, we're back here on Veterans Radio, and we're moving into our second segment. This portion of the program is going to be brought to you by the NVBDC. This is the National Veterans Business Development Council. And this is something that you need to think about. If you're a veteran and you own a business and you want to do business with the federal government or many corporations, you need to become certified, which shows that you are actually a veteran-owned business. And these are the people that can help you do that. So the National Veterans Business Development Council, you can go to their website, that's nvbdc.org, that's nvbdc.org, or give them a call at 888-CERTIFIED. Make sure that you do that, because this is the place to go. And they have all kinds of programs to help veterans who are either thinking about owning a business or already own a business. They can they have seminars, classes, everything else to help these veterans get their businesses going and be successful. So we encourage you to go to nvbdc.org. All right, joining me in on Zoom right now is my guest, Tom Stemke. And Tom, I met at our fundraiser a couple of weeks ago for Veterans Radio, the Radio on the River, and he was one of our speakers. And so I want to bring him onto the program. So Tom Stemke, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Dale, I'm honored that you asked me to be on today. Thank you for your service. I'm grateful for all the things you do for veterans, as I find out more and more as I realize just how many veterans are out there and how many veterans are listening. So thank you for that. And by the way, before you ask me the next question, I wanted to tell you that I served with the 189th. Camp Holloway, I think you said 186. I want to correct that without resorting to violence.
All right. Well, that's a good thing that you're on the other end of the screen here. I realize that, considering that you guys are the Ghost Riders. And
I was a gunship pilot and head of the gunship platoon, who were known as the Avengers. I'm sort of not real proud of the name, but anyway, that's the way it was. And it was a great unit for sure.
I think there were many, many great units over there, and I like to,
you know,
and we'll probably talk about a few of those types of things as we go along. So, Tom, I wanted you to come on and talk to our audience, because you, not only are you, you know, were you a successful pilot, and you were, you know, decorated with this distinguished flying crosses and air medals with V devices, and you know, many other things. I think it's amazing, you know, what what we were able to accomplish sometimes over there. How did you get involved in the military in the first place?
Okay, so we're going there. Well,
yeah, we are. We're going to go, we're going to do this chronologically.
I come from a family, with the exception of my father, who was disappointed he couldn't serve. He had an eyesight thing, but his four brothers, he was one of 10, his four brothers served, and one was decorated in the Battle of the Bulge. He really prompted me to join the service. Of course, he had full-time PTSD and was greatly affected by that terrible, terrible war. But the point is, these men and my whole environment, being raised in a northern Michigan small community, was we loved the flag, we saluted, we honored the elders, we listened. We were not perfect, but we were that kind of generation. And so when I got drafted at a young age, at 19, 27 of us got drafted from a small city, which was Sheboygan, 5,000. That's a lot of boys leaving at one time. Fortunately, everybody but one has made it back. But through that sort of process of wanting to serve but not knowing what we had to do, I was kind of gung-ho. And I won a distinction at my basic training class at Fort Knox, Kentucky, the American Spirit Award. That was one given to the brigade, and it meant a full ride to West Point. The story
I've never even heard of that award.
Yeah, it's cool. It goes on in the present. It's pretty amazing. There's a lot of programs that we don't know about that. But anyway, one out of the brigade wins. And but I was in love with my present wife, and you couldn't be married if you went to the point. And I was still pretty gung-ho to go to the point, but more gung-ho to get married. So I chose to get married, went to OCS. And out of that, Dale, I really started to involve myself, taking the advice of my uncle, go to all schools you can, Airborne, Ranger, Pathfinder, Special Forces, Jumpmaster, and then finally Aviation School. So I was really blessed because I had that opportunity. But when I was in Vietnam, I was only 20 years old, and that's pretty doggone amazing, really, to me.
It is, especially as a, you know, a 20-year-old. Well, when you got there, were you a first lieutenant?
I was a first lieutenant, was promoted to captain, like Ed, your previous guest. And I can't even imagine the responsibility we had as young officers, especially pilots. I mean, not only did you have to fly the aircraft and try to survive, you were in another. Anyway, it was a pretty interesting environment. And I'm just so glad to be able to think back now and have a somewhat a good mind frame, which comes out of hanging out with other veterans. I think this is so important. Thanks be to God, we have a local chapter. A lot of guys, your friends, our mutual friends, who really are veterans to the core and support other veterans and seek out guys like me who really had to be prompted for many years to come out and just kind of be real, I guess.
I think many of us, you know, were reluctant when we got home to, you know, talk about our experiences and just kind of wanted to meld back into society and, you know, get on with our lives. And I was, you know, as I've been doing this program over the last 19 years, I'm coming to really appreciate commissioned officers a whole lot more than I did when I was in the service, because as a warrant officer, you know, we had no responsibility other than the aircraft. That was it. No command responsibility. We didn't set up the flight schedules. We didn't set up for the pilots. We didn't set up the missions. We just followed orders and went out there. And as I get to talk to people like you, Tom, I find out that there are, you know, there's a whole lot of other things going on. And, you know, in addition to, you know, aircraft, the logistics of the whole thing, all the different things that go on out there. So when you got to Vietnam, did you go straight into guns?
The former gunship leader, I think he derosed. I'm not sure. Somebody, you may have been hurt. I'm not sure about that. But they there was a bit of a shortage of commissioned officers. Flying guns in Vietnam was an experience because you had to have a light touch. That thing was dangerous, in my opinion, to fly. Thinking about it gives me PTSD.
So you flew Charlie models?
Yeah, I flew Charlies, all overweight, trying to get 14,000 rounds off the ground and 14 rockets. I mean, I'm going to call that stupid at best. And with a density altitude of 3,500 plus. And the point of the story, Dale, is we learned to be good pilots. And if you were a gunship pilot, you were hitting on all cylinders. But I always thought if you were a slick pilot, you're not going to get me to hover above those 100-foot trees and with McGuire rigs pulling those boys. Not me.
Let me tell you a quick gunship story. I was in an LZ, and it seemed like I was down there forever. I don't know what was going on, but I can remember visibly seeing the guy shoot at me. And he was behind a tree about 75 yards away, and I could see the flash of the gun, and I'm trying to make myself small. And for those people who know me, I'm 6'2", so it doesn't, you know, doesn't work that way. So I'm my voice evidently goes up when I was getting shot at. So I'm saying, you know, I'm taking fire 11 o'clock, 75 meters, something like that. And the next thing you know, the tree is gone. The poor guy is gone. Everything is gone. And a gunship pilot comes over the radio and he says, "Is that better?" And he sounded like a pirate. And I said, "Yes, thank you very much." And he goes, "You're welcome." And continued on, you know, and I finally got out of there. But that's always been my impression of gunship pilots. They would do anything they could to protect us while we were doing those silly things of hovering over trees or, you know, underneath, you know, the canopies and dropping people off and picking them up and so on and so forth. We could always depend on our wing guys to be out there. But so you ended up with the 189th, the Avengers, and how soon before you were flying left seat or aircraft commander?
I think Dale, I was in country about 5 months. I was the platoon leader almost 7.5 months while I was there. I cannot believe I was so young, and yet I think by the grace of God, you were sensible. I mean, you were sensible. If you were a pilot, if you were a human being in Vietnam, you, for the most part, were sensible and made sensible decisions. Now, what happens in combat is you can be a hero if you really want to be. And I thought when you were flying and your warning light was beeping, and you 30-minute warning light, you know you got 45 minutes back, and you are filled with holes, and hydraulic light is beeping. You say, "Well, I don't think this is going to be good," but we made it back. And I could not believe how many heroes we met. And then I sort of came out of the woodwork and began to go to the reunions. My wife, I'm giving her the credit. I'm giving my wife credit for a lot of things and sort of my rehabilitation because I have 100% PTSD, and through self-pity and a bunch of other things, I had a little dark period, but I'm good now. And I am very much interested in giving back as much as I can, I suppose. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to do that and just to meet men like you, Dale, who really have served the veterans for a long time. It's unbelievable to me, really.
Well, I've only been doing this for, you know, about 20 years. I did not get involved, and this is kind of a local story for those of you out there, is that I was invited to go to our local VVA meeting one time, probably back in the early 90s, somewhere in that time period. And I walked into the room. This was done by John Kinzinger. You know, he's the main recruiter, I think. And I looked around the room and I said, they all look just like me. And next thing I know is that I'm hooked. I'm in with these guys. And, you know, I came to appreciate the enlisted man, as I said, the regular officers, everything. I came to appreciate everything that everybody did. And I'm going, wow, you know, this, what we accomplished, you know, whether you believe in the politics of the whole thing or not, is irrelevant. It's what we did for each other then to keep everybody, as many people as alive as we possibly could. And then right now, what we're doing, what you and I are doing, is we're just continuing the mission, Tom. We just want to keep every, you know, make sure that our veterans get whatever benefits that they're entitled to. We want to make sure that they're okay, you know, that they've got food, they've got shelter, whatever it is. And it's just, you know, everybody gets a calling at some point in their lives. And, you know, this was mine. And it's, you know, you are involved in it as well. It's kind of contagious, let's put it that way. And it's good contagious that we find out, you know, we find these men and women that, you know, we never even knew that they were veterans. And then we, you know, suddenly we have this little bond that we have, you know, because we all went through some sort of basic training. We all went through some sort of advanced training. If, you know, if you were in Vietnam, it didn't make any difference if you were flying gunships in the middle of the Oshawa Valley or wherever it was, or you were back in the base, you know, cooking the meals and so forth. You never knew when a rocket was going to come in, or a mortar, or a ground attack, or any of those things. So, I mean, we all lived with that tension for a year, and then suddenly nothing. And I think that's probably one of the things that affected so many of us, is we went from that super duper adrenaline high to real life, which does not necessarily have all those adrenaline highs on a regular basis. So tell me about, you don't have to go into specific, you know, events, but what was it really like to fly a Charlie model gunship? I mean, these things are, they're ancient. They kind of flap to get off the ground. Kind of, they look like a, I don't know what kind of bird it would be.
The thing, was so overweight because we flew a mission that many of us flew missions that required as much firepower as possible. And that would mean a full load of fuel. But I believe that the part of the helicopter, which we used to call skid shoes, had to be replaced in a matter of 2 to 3 days, because when you went off, especially if the runway was PCP, which it was at Camp Holloway, or whatever surface it was, you basically were skidding down the highway until you reach, the runway until you reached lift, which was great. Because the density altitude was so high in Central Highlands. Of course, you had a hill. I think the altitude was possibly almost 3,000 at the Central Highlands, I think. And the air was so thin, that thing just had a struggle to fly. Now, in a Charlie model, on a good day, when it was cool, possibly even raining, you could get that baby going 130 knots. in a 50 degree dye. That's cool. But then you have to pull out. That's not so good because it's like going into slow motion. So part of
everything is flapping and all the rivets are popping. And
okay. Else. So part of the main thing and tactics that we began to teach pilots was how to cover each other on the break. Of course, in our era, we all had the chance to go to Cobra school. Cobras, they brought a whole new level of firepower, which I thought kind of, in my opinion, turned the war at that point when that kind of firepower became, of course, the North was being bombed and so on. But anyway, flying helicopters, gunships, gosh, that required a skill, which I didn't say I had, but I mean, I'm amazed at the finesse to fly those babies and to keep on trucking.
You know? I think once once you find that, I don't know what it is, that certain something when you finally solo or you finally figure out not to wrestle with the aircraft,
oh, yeah.
It was the most sensational feeling I've ever had in my life. It was a magic carpet ride, and I could do anything, within reason, physics and so forth. But I could, I could go sideways, I could go backwards, I could stop at a because I didn't have all the guns and stuff involved in it. But I could stop at a hover at 1,000 feet if everything was copacetic, and then you could go as fast as you wanted to. I loved it when we were at our fundraiser and we were talking with General Henderson, who was a Marine pilot, jet pilot, and he's talking about going 600, 700 miles an hour, and I'm my comment to those guys is always, well, how fast can you go backwards? Can you stop? No. And you were talking about that when I was just envisioning, the gunship, going into one of their dives, and loosing all of their firepower on the bad guys on the ground and trying to pull out of that. That had to be a kind of it's almost like bad analogy, deciding if you're going to go through the red light or if you're going to stop. You kind of, okay, here's where I have to, if the light starts to turn, then I'm going to stop. If it doesn't, I'm going straight through it. And, when do you decide, okay, I got to pull out here? I'm sorry that our audience can't see Tom and I talking because our hands are doing all kinds of maneuvers on Zoom here of what to do when, you can't.
Well, Dale,
be a pilot and talk without your hands.
What you're talking about is they make movies about it. Don't they make something called Top Gun movies about all these things and making decisions and lights on and buzzers going off and going beyond that call of so-called duty. Oh boy, that's really something. I'm just continue to be amazed at the youth, just really the level of youth that is involved in conflict even in the present day. They're children fighting children. It's unbelievable.
You think about the responsibility we have. We need to take a break here. So I'm going to warn Derek. I want to take a quick break. And if you could play one of the VA PSAs and do the little bump music that I sent you after that. Okay. All right. So thank you very much. So you are listening to Veterans Radio. We're talking with Captain Tom Stemke, a helicopter pilot in Vietnam with the 189th Assault Helicopter Company. And we will be right back after this real quick message.
You know, you don't have to wear your PT gear anymore, right?
It's comfortable.
So how's civilian life treating you?
It's fine.
When I got out, I didn't want to admit that there was anything wrong because it felt like a failure. And then I realized, there's nothing to be ashamed of. So I started talking to someone. Maybe you are fine, but if you're not, it's okay.
Thank you.
If you or a veteran you know needs support, don't wait. Reach out. Find resources at va.gov/reach.
Yippee-i-oh.
That was a song that the, at least in my company, the 195th Assault Helicopter Company's choir would sing many evenings at the local watering hole. Johnny Cash and Ghost Riders of the Sky. I just had to play that. So we're talking here with Tom Stemke, and I was wondering if you, what type of missions did you go on? I know you were a support all the time. Did you go strictly with your own company, Slicks, or did you, you know, were you farmed out to different organizations?
We, of the 13 months I flew in Southeast Asia, Dale, I think 7 months were contributed to missions with PSYOPs and special forces. It was a totally different mission. It was the most professional, unbelievable mission that essentially was trying to acquire what was really going on in the war, getting people, just stuff you read in a storybook is just so cool. And being ex-special forces, and we had clearances. We hung out with these guys that were going in on teams. All of this was pretty darn exciting, I thought, and the most dangerous ever, all which could not have been done without rotary wing support. The real problem with guys who want to be heroes, these special forces guys, is they're not afraid to fight. I'm going to say 9.8 times out of 10, if there was an insertion with a team, they're going to get into trouble. And they required helicopters to get them out.
Usually at night.
At night, he said. I can tell you that I try to explain to my friends, even my wife, that I was pretty well scared most of the time. And when I was flying, I didn't have a death wish, but I really didn't think there was much hope, not hope, but a chance. I mean, the odds of those guys did not like aircraft. I mean, those NVA really started to know how to fight aircraft. They would lay on the backs and ran into an ambush one time where there must have been 50 guys on their back with AK-47s, and they really did some damage. That was the day I think I got in trouble. And but anyway, I guess when we tell these stories, I always think, Dale, that, man, were there a lot of other guys that were involved in the mission that I might have won a Distinguished Flying Cross. Oh, boy, there were a lot of other heroes who may have not even gotten mentioned. And, I was the head of a flight and laid it out there. And probably the one that gave me the most PTSD, I got a Silver Star for it. Everybody else got Distinguished Flying Crosses. And we're shaking our heads to this day how grateful we are. Really, we're grateful. I know all the Vietnam veterans that I hang out with, they're grateful. They're real. They've taken on a humility. They're not trying to prove anything. And I advocate for all veterans. I'm just there is no, there is no arrogance there at all.
No, I think the people that were arrogant, and every company had a few of those. You mentioned them a little bit earlier on, you know, the ones that wanted to be the heroes. And, you know, they were the ones that would take the chances. And sometimes they get away with it. Many times they didn't. And the problem is that when they didn't get away with it, they took other people with them. And that was always one of the issues that would that affected me over the years was witnessing some incompetence at different levels. And, you know, you'd see an aircraft, you know, go into an LZ when you knew that you just, it's not a good place to go. And, you know, they were trying to do the best that they could. And then, you know, one helicopter would get shot down and then two others would get shot down trying to get the one out. And the gunship would get shot down because they're out there trying to protect everybody. And it would just kind of snowball. The whole thing would continue that way. And I, you know, as I'm sure you mentioned, or that, you know, that you've gone through, is that you see things that you never imagined that you would ever see.
I guess it's okay to tell this kind of story, but I was just getting my a checkout ride when I arrived in 68, in March of 68, and a Tet was still on, excuse me, it was late February. And we were refueling at Old Dock Toll Strip, and a CH-47 came in, and I thought, I really didn't know what to think, but it looked like a sling load that was very unruly, I guess is the word. I said, what the heck's that guy carrying? I mean, I'm a kid from Sheboygan, and those sling loads were, they were body bags filled with boys coming in from Hill 875, if I remember. I don't want to say the wrong. I think it's Hill 875. But I'll tell you what, that really, really, really just went into my brain, and I could not believe it. It was so, so much of a shock. And then I realized that combat is not fun. Combat is hell on earth, in my opinion, and it's dark, and I think it's not a good place to be. But I'm so glad I'm in the U.S. I was in the U.S. Army. I'd never want to be in another country's army. We are citizens, and we're patriots, and we are. Yep.
We are.
Yeses are yes, and our noes are noes. That's
true. That is very true. We've got about 3 minutes to go, Tom. So where'd you go to R&R?
Of course, I met my honey on in Hawaii on December 25 with a Christmas tree stuffed in her suitcase. I don't even remember the Christmas tree, but there it was. And it was the most amazing, wonderful visit. And then I took a second one to Australia. I was sort of lonely at that time. I think I had about 2 or 3 weeks left, and I had the time off. And I was really wanting to get home at that time. As we all did. And I put in a lot of hours. We were flying a lot, especially in FOB. I would say as flyboys, we were putting on 5 to 6 to 7 hours a day. In rotary wing flight, that's a lot of hours or it more.
That is. I mean, I think I ended up with 1,200 hours or something like that. Yeah. And, you know, and then you spent the same amount of time on sitting, waiting. For the next mission. When you were talking about the Christmas tree, just a real quick story. Being October, my wife sent me a care package that had a pumpkin in it. And so we carved the pumpkin, of course. And this sounds really bad, but the Vietnamese, the Hooch girls, they were just scared to death of this thing because we'd carved it out, you know, put a candle in it and lit it up and kind of chased them around with it. But yeah, we got that. We got, you know, if it hadn't been for the women in our lives and our spouses, our moms and everything like that, I don't think it would have been possible to survive that.
Dale, my mommy sent me a box of prunes when I was in officer candidate school. And of course, you know, our mail was open to the packages. I was forced to eat these prunes. And then I had to wear a roll of toilet paper around my neck. Come on. I mean, hello. That is not where distinguished flying crosses come from.
No, it is not. It just goes to show that we are human. That's all it was. My mom sent a box of brownies to me in flight school, and we got caught, and we had to eat them all at once. And so
the shower was going, how about that?
I think we have many more stories to go along here, Tom. I want to thank you so very, very much being on the program today. It's been a pleasure to meet you, and I want to continue these conversations at another time where we can, have a cup of coffee or something to go with it. All right?
Likewise. Thanks again for your service, Dale.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Tom Skempe, thank you very much to Vicki for setting us up for the interview. Thank you.
On her behalf, she says thank you.
Okay. All right. So another episode of Veterans Radio is coming to an end. We want to thank our sponsors. Of course, that is Legal Help for Veterans, National Veteran Business Development Council, the Ann Arbor VA, Charles S. Kettles VA Health Center. Also want to make sure we thank the Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettles Chapter 310, and American Legion Post 46, all out of Ann Arbor. We can't do it without their financial support. We can't do it without you as our listening support. And we appreciate everything that you do to help us spread the word and spread the stories. So we're out of here. My name is Dale Thornberry. Until next week, you are dismissed.